Hello and a very Merry Christmas, one and all. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly, our Christmas special, with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards.
On today's programme, we'll be hearing from actor, director, and one quarter of the League of Gentlemen, Mark Gatiss. The master of the macabre will be discussing Christmas ghost stories a little later.
We'll also be hearing from the musicians Poppy Hankin and Joff Owen, better known as members of Girl Ray and The Boy Least Likely To. They'll be taking us through Christmas tunes and their own new one as duo Bubble and Squeak.
And we'll also be rethinking what to serve your guests over the festive season. Cook Ayuki Gomi will be telling us why sushi is a fun, easy and tasty party food to get friends and family around the table.
Plus a conversation with the director of stone-cold Christmas classics like Back to the Future and many more besides. That's Robert Zemeckis. He'll be discussing how he creates on-screen magic at the end of the show.
All that ahead here on the next hour on The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Man alive, I feel Christmassy, possibly due to some of the wonderful Christmas programming that's on Monocle 24, Tom, but also nothing says Christmas to me like sharing a studio with your good self.
I'll be back in the studio over the next couple of days, Rob. I'm going to drag you away from the festive table on Christmas Day itself.
I know, can't wait
for
that.
On our programme.
That's a special edition of
We'll be
briefing.
Dishing up some treats.
Yeah,
the briefing, a news programme on that day, truly like no other.
All right, Tom, well, let's start with some new sounds from a new duo. These are called Bubble and Squeak. They are Poppy Hankin of London band Girl Ray and Joff Owen, who's one half of the duo The Boy Least Likely To. Are you keeping up with me?
I'm with you so far, and I understand, Rob, that together they've created a new addition to the Christmas canon, the Christmas stick. Earlier, they sat down with Monocle's Tom Hall to discuss their musical partnership and some of the other great and maybe lesser-known pop favourites that we hear around the season. But first, here is that new tune by the pair, The Christmas Stick, from Bubble and Squeak.
Christmas can be a difficult time when you're feeling alone. Sitting by the window with a pack of mince pies, listening to knocking call. I only left the house to buy a bottle of wine when I saw you from across the street. I was looking out at all the Christmas lights when I saw you looking up at me. You never know that you're gonna fall in love until you do.
Well, Poppy's Bubble,
yeah.
I think. But the other day, someone asked who's Bubble and Squeak.
And I forgot about that.
And asked, yeah. And Poppy said she was Bubble, and then they asked me separately, and I said I was Bubble. But if they ask us together, Poppy's Bubble, I'm Squeak. But I'm not that happy being Squeak.
I thought you volunteered to be Squeak.
I don't want to be Squeak.
Why not?
Because, you know,
Bubble implies it's like Aunt Sponge and Aunt Spiker. Nobody wants to be either of them.
No. I definitely don't think... I think I'd be happier being Bubble, but it's too late now.
I'm just about to start a diet, so then I'll be Squeak.
A Bubble and Squeak breaking up in front of my very eyes.
Yes.
That was quick. So tell people a little bit about how Bubble and Squeak came to be, because you are actually known for your separate endeavours, Poppy in Girl Ray and Joff in The Boy Least Likely To, both very well-loved bands in themselves. How did you guys meet and how did you start making any music together?
Well, we met because Iris, who plays in my band, Girl Ray, she started working at Rough Trade and then became friends with Joff, who also works there. And then we became friends through that.
We talked about shoes.
We talked about other stuff as well.
Yeah, it was mainly shoes.
And then when we were at the pub one time, Joff told me about this idea he'd had for, like, how many years?
About 5 years I've talked about the Christmas stick. And I write with lots of other people, and I've always, like, thrown the idea out there, and no one's ever bitten before. No one's interested. And I told Iris about it, and she was like, you know, I think Poppy might like that. So I tried it out, and
loved it.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on what the Christmas stick is? That's the name of your single.
Yeah.
Lovely Christmas tune.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
I just thought it was a really funny phrase. And that was it. It just made me laugh.
But I kept him going for 5 years.
Yes. Yeah. Never made anyone else laugh until Poppy.
Until me.
And so I knew that was it. We had to write it. And then it was never like, I always thought in my head it would sound like Fat Les and it would be this huge sort of boisterous anthem, and then Poppy turned it into this really beautiful love song with a ridiculous joke in the middle of it.
Yeah. We also thought like it should be a bit more tongue-in-cheek throughout the song, like a lot more innuendo, but it ended up that sort of got scrapped a little bit.
Yeah, there's like, only
one. Turn Your Baubles Blue, that kind of
there.
Thing. Because I think duets, by nature, they got to tell a story, really, because it's...
Yeah. Yeah. And they don't usually have crude innuendos in them. So
no, they don't.
They were left out in the end.
Yeah.
And Geoff, you have form in this. I mean, there's you've done Christmas songs, a Christmas album in the past.
I mean, we've both got form, but I've done... This is my 15th Christmas song that I've written. So
I mean, this is a small cottage industry, right? Big hits, small hits. I mean, at Christmas time, I was going to come on to this. I mean, like Noddy Holder apparently gets like 800 grand every Christmas
That's the plan.
I mean, not to delve into your personal finances, but if you write enough of them, people are streaming. Do you get like an eighth of a penny every time that these things get played?
That's a really good
question. I mean, this isn't... Christmas songs haven't ever paid for any...
Christmas hasn't paid for itself.
It hasn't paid for itself. But I think this is the best shot I've had so far. This is definitely the biggest Christmas song I've had.
Yeah.
Is it bigger than your Christmas song, Poppy?
I don't.
You had one last
year. Well, we put everything into that Christmas song.
Did you not put everything into this one?
No, I did. We did it again.
Okay.
But I mean, like, we spent like 3 days recording with like strings, and we made...
Oh, that's more. Yeah.
You know, we
choir.
Got like
children's choir.
Children's choir. We actually got children's choir. So, in comparison to how much work we put in, that hasn't paid for my retirement yet.
You haven't got 3 days worth of
even 3 days of wages. No. But this one, I do think could actually fund the retirement.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're both kind of old hands at this craft, let's call it. Are there any absolute essentials that should be in a Christmas song? Because I was listening to yours, no sleigh bells.
Yes.
I noticed. There's some chiming. I couldn't pick up on sleigh bells.
They are low in the mix.
They are low in the mix.
Too low.
They are low in the mix. They are there, though.
That's annoying.
We had the sleigh bell conversation. Do you want to go there?
They're definitely in there. They come in, but they're not...
They're not, like, front and centre.
No. We didn't lead with the bells.
No.
So were you going for something maybe more subtle, or, you know, or is this something which you're going to fire the person who did the mix for?
No. I think sleigh bells are sort of... That is one of the secrets of a Christmas song. Well, not it's not a secret.
Is that going to cost us the... Retirement fund.
No, but I think, you know, it's sleigh bells, it's like, there are certain just Christmassy chords as well, secret Christmas chords, that kind of tug at the heartstrings.
How do you learn those? Do you have to go to a special academy?
You go to Nepal, and you sort of drink this tea in this mountaintop village, and then you sort of just have this sense of what chord. I think Geoff Buckley spoke about it in Hallelujah.
Well, the one that David plays.
Yes, the one that David plays. Please the Lord. No. I don't know. Some of them just sound Christmassy and sad. It's like happy, sad. And yeah, there are just certain things that are, you know, in all Christmas songs that you can't really avoid.
So I wanted to play in a couple of clips of Christmas songs, and some of them very well known, some of them maybe slightly less known.
This is a quiz.
Well, well, kind of. There's a quiz element.
Okay,
but what I wanted to ask you is because, like, Christmas songs, they tend to be one-hit wonders, don't they? And I just wondered if maybe you knew a single thing about the people that play them. So we'll play them in. First we'll ask who did it, because that's the first thing.
It's a quiz. This is great.
And then we'll ask if you can remember anything about who these people were. So.
Okay.
Jingle bells around the street and presents on the sled. Hey, look at the Mayor's Derby on top of Dominic's head. A pair of shoes for Louis and a dress for Josephine. The label on the inside says they're made in Brooklyn. Hey, jingity-jing, it's Dominic the Donkey. Jingity-jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La, 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 la.
Dominic the Donkey there. Do we know who sang that?
Dominic the Donkey, isn't it?
Dominic. I
think
you're the expert.
Anyway,
do you know that?
I know the song, yeah. And they played the other night.
Really?
After we played, the DJ dropped that. And it's a banger. It's got that E-on.
Oh,
sound
I was really confused when they put that on, yeah.
But, I mean, it is quite a deep cut.
Who's it by?
I don't know who it's by, actually.
It's by Lou Monti.
Oh, I should know that.
He was sort of kicking about in the 1950s, 1960s. I think that's from 1960. He's, I believe, East Coast, US, New Jersey, perhaps. But he was of Italian heritage.
And is that his big hit?
It's the one that people still play. Do you know any of his other hits?
No, I'm just saying, like, if you wrote that and you heard that in Tesco every year, you would probably send you a bit mad, wouldn't it?
Yeah, every year, yeah.
Like the Eeyore bit.
It's catchy, though.
It's catchy.
But also, I bet the Montes probably raking it in, aren't they?
Yeah, they're probably not shopping in Tesco anymore.
No.
Probably gone, like, Selfridge food hall. Yeah. Selfridge food hall.
Okay, we'll do another. We all know what that is, I think. Who is that?
The Waitresses.
Indeed.
That's a banger. Yeah.
Do we know anything about who the Waitresses were? What kind of music they did outside of that?
No.
I've got their album.
Have you?
Yeah, because they do I Know What Boys Like as well. And it's a great record. Yeah, the album's really good. But it's just like early 80s post-punk sort of indie pop thing.
Akron, Ohio. Same sort of place
Ohio.
As Devo.
Really?
That kind of crowd, I think.
I was going to guess like New York.
Sounds quite Scottish, I've always felt.
Really? Bagpipes.
We'll go for our third and final one. Okay.
So I took a permanent vacation to lose the walls and all these Christmas blues. My soul was freed. I went to court. The trial was short.
Any ideas?
No, it sounds like sort of my voice memos from like the other day, just alone and crying by the piano. No idea what that is.
That is Christmas with Satan by James White, who went on to become James Chance and the Contortionists.
Oh. That's pretty out there.
Deep cut.
Yeah. These are deep really, cuts.
That's a real deep cut. Yeah, we didn't hear that at the disco the other night.
No, that did not come on.
So, yeah, as you mentioned, you were discoing and you were performing as well the other night.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your playlist when you're kind of going into those seasonal kind of club spaces, in a sense.
I mean, there's obviously the bangers, you know, the Wham, the Waitresses, the Shakin' Stevens. And there's a few deep cuts along the way. There's this thing called the Song Poem Anthology. Do you know about this? Where people used to, like music studios used to advertise for people to send their poems in and they'd set them to music.
Really?
And then they'd write back with their poems and they'd be like, oh, it costs £300, by the way. And the idea was that people could write a song and they'd get hit, they'd like have a massive hit and live off the royalties. But they'd pay £300 to do it. So they'd send these terrible poems in and then the studios would write a song and send it back to them for £300. And of course, they never became hits. Anyway, there's a compilation of these songs,
wow,
which I really love, called Song Poem Anthology
that?
Christmas.
The 50s, you say?
Like the 60s,
oh,
yeah.
Wow.
And there's this song on there that I always play called Santa Came on a Nuclear Missile, which is quite deep, but it sounds like Sheena Easton. It's like it's a deep cut, but
yeah,
it's a real banger. So that would always be on there.
Santa, bring me laughter.
I think that you can write a good Christmas song out of...
Oh, you know, was that directed at us? Do you think next year you could write a good one?
The mics are still on, Jeff. But do you think that you can write a good one? Maybe, okay, so songwriting, sometimes people have lots of bits. They have like bits of songs lying around and stuff. And it's like maybe the Christmas Stick. I mean, that's a good song. It's like maybe some of those bits didn't just materialise out of the sort of snow and candy of Christmas. They've been kind of like parts of proper, in quote marks, songs in the past. Do you think that a Christmas song really has to start out as one and stay as one the whole time? Or Do you think that maybe you could be trying to write one and then suddenly you're like, this is not a Christmas song, this is something else?
Yeah, I almost took the Christmas, because it was so, the tune was so nice that Poppy had written, that when I was sort of working on the words, I was thinking, maybe we should take out the joke in the middle of it, because it's actually a really beautiful song. And it would have worked anyway, it's a really sweet song. But in the end, it was like, nah, joke's too good.
Yeah.
But yeah, it could have survived.
I don't know. I think you do need to get in the mood a bit to write a Christmas song, or to write like a traditional Christmas song. I know with the Galway Christmas song, though, that we released last year, that started as like one of the earliest songs we'd ever like demoed and put out on SoundCloud, which it was like half the song, and it was just a regular Galway song. But then... I had always thought that the verse was super Christmassy, so I took the verse and then I wrote a new chorus, and I wrote like an epic outro with the child choir. So I guess that in that sense, you don't have to, but it probably helps to sit down and, you know, have a vision.
And finally, what are you guys doing for Christmas this year? Is it all out mad celebration, quiet? What goes on in Joff's household and Poppy's?
Just doing some family stuff, but in the evening we're meeting, we're hanging out.
Yeah, friends Christmas.
Christmas Day, friends Christmas. So we'll probably play board
probably
game.
Play. We like to make our own Cards Against Humanity with weird. And you know what's going to be a card this year that we can make? What? The Christmas stick. It'll just say the Christmas stick.
And that's
because you make all the questions, you make all the answers yourself. It's really fun.
So we'll probably do that. Christmas Against Humanity.
Christmas Against Humanity.
Yeah.
Yeah. At my house, it's just like a big... All my family's coming over and stuff. It's like totally classic. But yeah, then in the evening, we'll hang out with our... Buds. Yeah, that'll be good.
Come round.
Come round, yeah. Christmas spirit's coming around, I heard you say.
Poppy Hankin and Joff Owen there, or Bubble and Squeak as they're known, for about the next 7 days at least. And you can find out more, of course, online, or track down the excellent work of Girl Ray and The Boy Least Likely To as well. We'd highly recommend that. Stay with us. You're tuned into The Monocle Weekly. Mark Gatiss coming up next. Now, among Christmas's many traditions, the most thrilling must surely be that of the ghost story. In fact, the tradition of telling spooky stories goes back further than that of telling kitschy, schmaltzy pap. Ghoulish seasonal visitations pop in Victorian literature and much earlier.
Today, rather than gathering around the hearth for a Noel nightmare, families warm more to the glow of the TV set for their fix of festive fright. 2018, Rob, is no exception. The BBC spooky tale this year has been written and directed by Mark Gatiss, horror aficionado, co-creator of The League of Gentlemen and Sherlock, and general all-round polymath and good egg.
Exactly. Monocle's Augustin Macellari caught up with Mark to learn more about the upcoming The Dead Room and to ask, what do we like to get frightened at Christmas? But first, here's a sneak peek.
See, forgive me, but for a proper ghost story, you have to have certain elements, certain rules that... make it work.
Actually, we'd better be getting back.
Ideally, we should meet the characters in an ordinary way, just chatting about everyday things, food, drink, etc. And into this apparent calm, the bad thing rears its ugly head. Unobtrusively, at first, but then more insistently, until it holds the stage. It's all about creating the right atmosphere.
For the uninitiated, the Christmas ghost story is maybe quite a strange idea. I think people will think of the Christmas Carol and the ghosts that visit Ebenezer Scrooge. But in fact, it has quite a strong tradition, especially in the UK. What can you tell me about the background to it?
It's a strange thing. I think it feels very British. I think it is, though, probably worldwide. It's something to do with the darkness, I think. And there's a reference in, I wish I could remember which Shakespeare play it is, but it's about winter stories. It's not actually a winter's tale. There was a man dwelt by a churchyard. And there's something about the conjunction of the sort of festiveness and the likeness of it with the darkness, which somehow... goes together. In a modern sense, I use that term lightly, it's definitely Dickens which fused it into a thing with A Christmas Carol. They seem to go correctly together. They just always have done. So there was a great ghost story boom in the 19th century. A lot of wonderful stories culminating in M.R. James, who is the master of them all. It's a continuing tradition. I think a lot of writers want to have a crack at one. And for some reason, they just do go with Christmas. I've always been utterly obsessed with them all my life. And even there's a horror aficionado, ghosts are my favourite thing. And I grew up watching the BBC adaptations of M.R. James and Dickens, directed by the brilliant Lawrence Gordon Clark in the 70s. Now, this is my third Christmas ghost story, so it's a tradition which has to continue, and I always get very vexed when there isn't one. I don't really mind, I do, if it's not me making them, but there's a yearning for it, and the yearning is expressed by the fact that they repeat them because people know there should be something, particularly on Christmas Eve. And so I'm very excited about having done another one.
You just gave me a clue. You said that you watched the ones that were broadcast in the 70s, sort of, religiously, but was it, what first captured you? Was it the film or was it the literature?
Oh, I have very vivid memories. There are two particular stories I remember reading as a child which really warped me. One is called Man Size in Marble by E. Nesbitt. And I think I must have come to E. Nesbitt through, you know, her famous children's stories. But this is a very scary story about a couple on a holiday and they go to this church which has two enormous crusader effigies, a man and a woman. There is a legend that on a certain night of the year they get up and walk around. And they do. And it absolutely petrified me. And there's another story by Agatha Christie called The Lamp, I think it is. Anyway, but I can remember they were probably in sort of children's anthologies, you know. But because I was always drawn to anything supernatural, it just sort of got me into it, and much more so than vampires or werewolves or anything. I just love the idea of ghosts and what they represent and the sort of history of them, I suppose. So it's just always been my favourite thing. And then, as I say, being so attracted to TV and anything vaguely supernatural, then those Christmas ghost stories just lit my world.
You've brought us a new one this year.
Yes.
The Dead Room, which I've seen and is... people will be pleased to hear, satisfyingly chilling.
Good.
and we'll talk a bit more about that. Simon Callow in it plays the kind of lead. He's this old actor, and I don't want to give too much away, but he at one point calls M.R. James the master, and I rather wondered if that was you speaking through him.
It is, but it's also everybody else. I mean, without giving too much away, the genesis of this story is that a few years ago on Radio 4 Extra, I was very privileged to be the man in black, which is a very old radio tradition, goes right back to the war, and a brilliant actor called Valentine Dial, who had the most incredible voice in radio. I remember ringing my dad up and saying, "You won't believe it, I'm the man in black." But it's a format which is as old as the hills, which is essentially, you know, are you sitting comfortably? Good evening.
The sentence, a dread sentence of death, was the last of distinct accentuation which reached my ears.
When I was doing it, the producer would say, "Will you write one of the stories?" And I never had the time really. And I said, "I tell you what, I'll do the very last one. When we get to the end, I'll do the last one, and it should be about me, in this studio, being haunted for real." Anyway, we never got to do it, but I kept the idea. And when this possibility of doing another one came up, I thought that's perfect because it's very doable. It's very cheap. I wanted to do something different, that's the thing. The last one I made 5 years ago was an adaptation of an M.R. James called The Tractate Middeth, and I really wanted to make it like one of... it would fit in with the Lawrence Gordon Clark ones, and I thought, this time, I'm going to try and take it on a bit. So what I've done is, it's an original story, but I've adapted, as it were, M.R. James's rules for ghost stories. He wrote several brilliant introductions to his stories and other people saying, this is what I think you need to do. So what I've done is I've articulated that. Simon's character says, this is what you need to do, which I rather like, because obviously as he's saying them, we are doing them at the same time. But then I thought, you know, I wanted to make it about something unexpected. It's a sort of daytime ghost, which I always find very frightening. And also, one of M.R. James's rules is about the thing he called the haze of distance. So if it's too far back, you believe anything's possible. If it's too recent, it's too immediate, it's not the same. You need about 30 or 40 years. And ideally, it said, something happened to a friend of mine once. It needs a sort of little dislocation. But what occurred to me, you see, is that in the 70s, they are mostly set in the 30s, or even further back, Victorian ones. And I thought, well, if you're doing it now, the ghost really needs to be from the 70s. And I thought, well, that's genuinely interesting. I don't know if I've seen that before. And it's like taking all the traditional trappings and actually seeing if they still work in what feels to me like very much living memory, you know. So that's what I've tried to do.
It strikes me that there are some ghost films that might not be so appropriate for a kind of Christmas airing. You might not want to watch The Ring, you know, the original Japanese one around Christmas. I mean, you might.
Watching it on Christmas Day after The Queen.
Exactly. I kind of wanted to ask about where the conditions that designate a Christmas ghost story as opposed to a Halloween one?
I don't know. I mean, I know what you mean about Ringu. It's so bleak and strange and frightening. And there is inevitably, I suppose, there's something comforting, isn't it, about the juxtaposition of Christmas and ghost stories. But at the same time, one of M.R. James's great rules was the ghost must be malevolent. Nice ghosts belong in fairy tales. And I think he's dead right. There needs to be some... There's usually a revenge aspect or someone has transgressed, someone has done something very bad. Or even not bad, they've just transgressed. You know, no digging here. Don't do that or you'll get punished.
Be a bugger to move that. Moving the gate too.
Down at the end.
Looks nice there.
It's spoiler lawn though.
Oh, well, still, I wouldn't move it.
So that's a strong aspect. And yet, I know what you mean. There are some things that would feel much more appropriate on Halloween. But I don't think it has to be cosy. I don't think the Dead Room is cosy. It's actually quite challenging. And I think a lot of them are more disturbing than you'd think. But I suppose it's also something to do with the trappings. Just actually wrapping it up as one sends a message, doesn't it? That it's a ghost story for Christmas. It's not for any other time of the year, apart from repeats.
They're also kind of really pleasantly self-contained. You know, the M.R. James stories are very short, still punchy. That thing you said about comfort was something that I settled on when I was thinking about this, because they are disquieting. But I, for some reason, in the Christmas ghost story, disquietingness and comfort can kind of coexist.
Well, it's like Christmas itself. You see, I think that's a big part of it. And one of the reasons it works is that Christmas is by no means an unalloyed joy for most people. For a start, it can be very stressful. And, I mean, I've lost count of the amount of people saying, oh, no, I've got to do this, we've got to go to his and then to hers. And you think, it's like if everyone had a meeting and said, shall we just do what we like? There'd be a national sense of relief, which would save us all. But also, it can be a very, very sad time. A lot of people have lost people at Christmas, or they obviously remember them at Christmas. I think it's a very melancholy time, sometimes squeezed into a Christmas stocking of enforced jollity, which gives it a slight dislocation, which I think is where this area works.
Spirit, are these people real, or are they shadows?
They're real. We're the shadows.
Both of us.
Did you not cut yourself off from your fellow beings when you lost the love of that gentle creature?
I wanted to ask a bit as well about folklore, because I kind of was reading around and some people sort of implied that maybe the tradition, the oral tradition of spooky stories at Christmas was related to the pre-Christian pagan rituals, which I thought it was an interesting idea. And this sort of genre of folk horror, which you spoke about in your series on horror films, has experienced something of a kind of revival recently. And I wanted to ask what your reflections on that ascendance of this different strain of quite British, deeply rooted and more folk related.
Christmas is an almost entirely invented tradition. It does, of course, go way back. But in terms of what we know to be Christmas, it is largely a product of post-Christmas carol. It's a bit like the Council of Nicaea when they decided what was going to go in the Bible. There was a sort of decision made to bring back some things. I remember watching a documentary about this, and there used to be a Christmas tradition of a sort of very violent football match on Boxing Day, which people just beat the hell out of each other. And they thought, maybe we won't bring that one back. But we've all grown up thinking this is millennia old, and some parts of it are, but it's the same with sort of folk horror. We draw on a thing which we assume to be there, which we all love. I think we all do, that sense of, like, if you go too far into the countryside, they might still have corn dollies and they might be burning a wicker man and stuff like that. And it's as fascinating if it is ancient as if it's not, I think, because in the same way, it's like people can fall victim to this sort of superstition quite swiftly. I think they do. I think people do it all the time. People who believe in crystals and all that sort of thing, you think, well, this is just medieval. What's wrong with you? So I love tapping into that, and I think everybody does, and all those any folk horror does. You know, it does feel very British, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was you could find a strand of it across the world, because I could absolutely imagine something set in rural France, which had a very similar vibe to it, because things do go way, way back.
And then I found myself on Gallows Hill. It felt like a very unnatural kind of place.
I was also going to ask a bit about this new, I mean, it's been much touted now, this kind of new intelligent horror drive, which seems to be linked in some way to the folk horror revival. While I was reading some of these stories, just thinking about this interview, it struck me that intelligent horror is a bit of a trite label, because they're very clever, they're thoughtful and they're thought-provoking. It doesn't seem that new, but why are people willing to give horror the benefit of the doubt now if they've previously consigned it to B-movies or Grindhouse?
Well, I mean, partly because it was. And in fact, one of its chief joys is exactly that. A lot of films that were dismissed in their time are now looked upon as art house classics, or certainly Terence Fisher, the great Hammer director, is an auteur in France. He never was here. He was a sort of workman-like director as far as British critics were concerned. But people detect things which may or may not be there in a person's work. There's a real sort of sense of something going on, isn't it? And I think it might be really to do with an awful lot more of the people making the decisions are actually fans. You know, the geek will inherit the earth, as I'm always saying. And there are a lot of people now who have a different kind of view of genre than they did 20 years ago. They've really grown up and they have great respect for things. And the icons of those things, whether actors or directors or producers or whatever, they know what they're talking about, they know their stuff. And that whole thing of treating it seriously whilst not losing the fun of it, I think is a really interesting place to be. And from my own perspective, I'm like an addict constantly trying to get back to their first hit, because nothing frightens me now. I can't tell you how many times people have said to me, oh, this is the one, this is the new Exorcist. And I don't feel it. And I usually end up, my favourite catchphrase these days is daft. It's a bit daft, that. You know, I loved like A Quiet Place. I thought that was terrific. And really tense, but it's a sci-fi thriller, you know. And Hereditary, I found the best bit genuinely harrowing was when the little girl gets killed, but that's nothing. I mean, there were some really nice little bits, but mostly I just thought, this is really daft. I don't know quite what I'm looking for, but I have not found it. And I think that's a very interesting place for everyone to be, because your new audiences are constantly coming up and they get Halloween and it's their Halloween because they didn't know the original. It's sort of reinvented and that's fantastic. But in the end, there's only so many ways you can scare people, and trying to find something that's genuinely original is extremely difficult.
Finally, it's kind of a final thought. It's striking that you're saying that daft are the horror films, but scary are the stories. And I suppose there's something about the intimacy of reading, famously, that makes it easier to freak oneself out. Yeah. But then seeing a ghost story that's made for TV, that's made for a domestic setting rather than for watching in the cinema, I think there's something quite spooky about that as well.
Oh, yes. I mean, as you said about the brevity of the form, that half an hour, 40 minutes is about the right time. If you're talking about a feature-length ghost story, it has to be something very different, I think, like The Innocents or The Haunting. You know, it's an actual big-scale thing. But there's something about that, setting in a radio studio, it is an odd space, isn't it? Here we are.
Here we are.
And a dead room with no other sound. And you can tailor it very well, I think, to the setting. And the strange, cloying ordinariness of things can be very spooky, as we know, and if you've ever had any kind of supernatural experience, but the way you imagine it'll happen is exactly that, is you're sitting here late at night when everyone else has gone home and you just look through that little window there and see a face.
Mark Gatiss there in conversation with Augustin Macellari. And those listening in the UK will be able to watch The Dead Room at 10 p.m. Christmas Eve tomorrow night on BBC4 or catch up at your leisure on demand after the fact. This is a special Christmas edition of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. We'll be learning how to liven up your Christmas menu, Rob, with a little sushi after this. You join us, listeners, in the kitchen. We've escaped Studio One because we're talking food with Japanese chef Yuki Gomi. Now, you might be thinking, who reaches for the raw fish at Christmas? But with the cholesterol and carbs scaling somewhat ungodly heights, some refreshing sushi sits well among the holiday and New Year calendar. And for gatherings, it's ideal for involving family and friends in some DIY tamaki rolls.
Yuki Gomi is a cordon bleu chef who's made and taught about food in cities ranging from Tokyo to Chicago and her home here in London. And she's here to tell us more. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. So tell us first, Yuki, why Christmas is an unusual but good time for sushi, maybe?
Well, a lot of people kind of enough Western buttery heavy food. So I wanted to show something different. And everybody loves sushi. And also you can choose a lot of different varieties. So it can be a vegetarian and can be a meat even, or fish option, or cooked. So many variety, and then people can pick and then enjoy together. So that's what I thought is great.
Shall we get started with one of the dishes? Maybe tell us some of the things you've got and what you think we should, yes, should kick off with.
So basically, these stuffs you can buy very easily from the shop. And especially London, or a very good fishmonger, if you know, and you can buy it. You don't have to go to a special Japanese shop or supermarket at all. So here is a tuna, good tuna, sushi quality. Even high-end supermarkets selling the sushi-grade tuna. And salmon, obviously here is a very good Scottish salmon, so easy to get, it's very fresh. And so you can use that, and avocado is always good. It's not Japanese vegetables, but it's been for a long time.
We're getting a little Californian here.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So it's like very, very popular. And also, it's not only raw fish. So here is a cooked prawn. You know, it can be you can use crabs or even scallops or a lot of seafood if you want to. And here is a deep-fried prawn.
Prawn. I was going to call him a langoustine. He's a prawn.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is a very nice
or shrimp.
Shrimp.
I've got my eye on those ones in particular.
Everybody loves that. So we're going to deep fry with a panko, which is Japanese breadcrumb. It's very easy. And then you just deep fry. So lots of different variety. And edamame, which is great for vegetarian. And also this is a fish egg. So if you go to the...
Oh, lovely.
Posh fishmonger, you can buy that too.
We've got a sour plum there? What have we got in there?
So this is called umeboshi. Actually, this is great for sushi as well. It's obviously a vegetarian option, but plum, Japanese plum, umeboshi, it's really good. Actually, it's great for that people who are pregnant, lady. It's a sour and it's good for your health. So you can buy from a healthy shop.
What should we kick off with?
Yes, of course, sushi is the most part of the rice, so very important. Yeah. So if you have a nice sandwich, you have to have a nice, beautiful artisan bread. So same thing, so you need to have a beautiful, well-cooked rice. So we are obsessed about rice, but actually you can buy very reasonable price. And also you can go to any local supermarket, Sainsbury, Tesco, Waitrose, any place you can buy as well. As long as, say, Japanese rice or sushi rice. So one thing you need to do first, wash your rice.
You get quite a lot of scum off it, don't you? You get quite a lot of dust off it, I should say, right?
You might get some food poison from that.
Okay.
So it has a lot of bacteria or the dust, and you need to get rid of it. So we call polish it. So we don't use the verb for wash it. So my mum always said, can you polish the rice?
I like, because you're dealing with
each individual grain.
Perfection almost.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not about just cleaning. It's about elevating the whole experience.
So we use the verb polish it. Okay. So we polish obviously with the water about 2-3 minutes until clear waters come out. So I can talk about rice probably 2-3 hours, but I don't do it.
We could listen that long.
We could listen that long.
We need some additional progress.
Yes.
But this looks great. So this has been through all of your rigorous processes.
Yes.
Do you always have a sort of a batch ready to go, just in case you're in sushi making mode? Or is it important? Is freshness important?
Yes, freshness is kind of important, but actually it's quite simple. So if you take my recipe, so first wash the rice and soak into the water with same amount of water and rice. Okay. Make sense?
Yep.
So equal amount.
Uh-huh.
Ideally, best result 2-4 hours.
Okay.
So it can be overnight as well. But of course, life is short, so you can do about at least half an hour.
Squeaky clean.
Yes, clean and soaking.
Okay.
So shall we do, let's cut the fish then.
Yeah, let's do some cutting up.
Yes. This is a beautiful tuna here. Mm-hmm. So I asked the fisherman to slice it. So you don't need that massive amount, just one steak or two. And then can you see this part? Sinew, you know?
Uh-huh.
So this part is, has lines, so you now really wanted to eat it. But actually, it's quite tasty part. So I show you how to make the spicy tuna.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing waste. It's super easy. So this one, I'm going to leave it. And then this part is like a mountain part. This is really good akami red part. So I'm going to cut it here. And then you can use this one for the rolls to make the strips. Or we can do like sashimi, like slice. So do you want to try to, or do you want me to do it?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it. And like this, 20 degree. And 90 degree to finish.
Oh, okay.
It's like a zen. Focus.
Am I cutting this way?
Yes. So from the heel, just slice it.
So you're sort of guiding that. You're using the weight of the knife and you're kind of guiding it.
Yeah. So like cello or violin.
Yeah. I've done that quite badly.
Yes.
That's terrible.
Good. I think there was good focus.
The focus.
No, it's good. Very good. And then this part, do you remember the sinew part? Mm-hmm. It's very unpleasant to eat.
Yeah.
Because you can't break the tissue. So it's more like tissue.
Uh-huh.
So you just need to separate like this with a spoon. Unfortunately, I don't have this recipe on my book. I thought it's too Western.
Yeah, okay.
But everybody loves it.
So how do you do that? How do you decide which recipes go in the book? Because there obviously are things which are kind of a complete bastardization of the Japanese
tradition. Yeah, I try to
be
modern.
Yeah.
And most important, people can buy it from the local place. So I don't want to go to always ordering the special Japanese shop because my clients from everywhere, sometimes countryside, it's not only Londoners, and also can be more outside of England as well. So try to people buy more easily. Mayonnaise is a big thing for Japanese. Mm. We have a QP mayonnaise. We
yeah,
have
I love QP.
But you don't have to have a QP, but you have an English one as well. Anyway, so a little bit of mayonnaise on top of the tuna and sriracha.
Mm-hmm.
So we call Asian ketchup.
Yeah.
So you can buy it everywhere in the Asia, Asian shop or supermarket and a little bit, as much as you want. Are you okay with the heat? The spicy?
Mm, I'm an enthusiast of spicy food.
And a dash of soy sauce, obviously. Here you go. Then, chives. I always chop the chives. So you can put the chopped chives on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Then, sesame seeds. Black sesame seeds, white sesame seeds. I always mix together and just put in here.
A healthy dose of sesame seeds, sir.
Yeah.
A good measure.
Yeah.
So mix together, a little bit of naughty things and then good things all together.
Nice.
So this is basically most restaurants recipe like this.
Should we try one? Tom, when you have first dibs.
Okay,
with a little rice disher upper.
And also you can put, if you're hungry, you can put as much as you want rice.
Yeah.
And if some lady don't want to eat any rice so much, you can put them much less. Or you know, whatever you like, you choose.
Yuki, I can't remember what I'm doing with this.
Are you left-handed?
Right-handed.
No. Right-handed, so you need to
put it into this hand.
Yes. Then cross the thumb.
Yeah.
So this one goes to the top. So just bring
up. So that just goes like that.
Yeah, then it kind of stand up.
And then that's it.
And you just wrapped up. So end of the day, it doesn't matter the how shape it's because you're going to eat immediately. It's like a crepe.
It is like a crepe. It's looking delicious. I can't really resist any.
Go for it, Rob.
It's a bit leaking, but it's okay.
That's seriously good.
Is it?
Very, very nice. Very nice indeed.
Good. So we're going to carry on more. So basically a slice of fish, tuna here, so you can do the fresh tuna as well.
Mm-hmm.
And shall we move on?
Yum, that's good.
So a little bit different filling. So we're going to do breadcrumb, deep fried prawn.
Okay.
So we call ebi fry.
So how long are we deep frying the prawns for, the shrimp for?
3 minutes. Okay. 180, 70 degree. It's like same as a schnitzel, same as fry, basically.
Okay.
Flour, egg, and breadcrumb. Mm-hmm. So we call Japanese breadcrumb called tanko. Mm-hmm. So it's much more fluffy and nice. So next one is called sweet chili sauce mm-hmm. with this panko. Breadcrumb prawn. So I'm going to make the quick sauce with it.
So you're going quite, there's quite a lot of sauce involved in this. Some people might go, oh, wow, hang on. The only people associate soy and wasabi, maybe in their lunchtime sushi kind of habit, eating habits. But we're going pretty saucy here. We've got something that looks like a sort of Mary Rose sauce.
Kind of more modern way.
Yeah,
way. Of course, soy sauce is more classic way, but it's nice to have a more different flavor or fun to mix together. And sometimes a bit raw off. But it's quite fun, right?
Splodge him on top.
Yeah.
So this is quite unceremoniously done, isn't it?
I mean,
you've got to be, you're being fairly firm with this stuff, Yuki. We're not dancing around delicately. The thing in the end looks beautiful.
Yeah,
but,
fun.
But you're
Okay, so over again.
So again, you do, you're quite neat.
I'm quite neat. Yeah. And then
stand
upright.
Up. Yeah.
And
wrapped
then
up.
Twist.
Yes. Then I'm going to pour the...
Oh, I'm getting good at this, Rob.
Yeah, you're very good. And then I'm going to put this sauce.
Is that like that? You've got that in the wrong hand. So this just goes up here again?
Yes. Yeah. Perfect.
Like that?
And then, nope. Like that. And stands up.
Stands up.
And then I'm more wrapped up. More. So this one goes like this and then like this.
It's all right. I'm hoping in a couple of years to be able to tie my own shoelaces.
This may be my greatest achievement since I've worked.
Look how delicious that looks.
Hey. Go for
Let's
it.
Try this.
Now, just on another point, do I just... The whole thing, I just take the whole thing down. I don't leave the little tail grabby doodah bit, do I?
We eat everything.
Okay.
Mm. Good calcium.
Don't need to be told twice. Mm.
This bottom left corner is going up to the top.
Bring to the top, like this. You can see the triangle. Stands up, wrapped up, like a bouquet.
It's not bad.
No, it's much better.
I never make it as a florist or a sushi chef.
Merry Christmas.
Kanpai. I'm going to eat this.
Yes, please.
Okay. Tadakimasu. That's delicious.
Yes, more refresh, like freshness.
Mm. That's really good.
Yes, this is very fun to do and easy. Mm. So, yeah, it's like a fondue concept, basically.
Mm.
So, everybody, so think about that if you roll the sushi for 10 people or 10 guests, it's a lot of... work.
So this is a good way of involving your guests in inverted commas and getting them to do some of the work.
Yes, and then guests can do that for you.
It's absolutely delicious stuff. Thank you so much.
Yuki, this has been an absolute delight. Your brilliant book, Sushi at Home, can make what we have just done a reality for people everywhere. Mm. So they have, a moral obligation to go and purchase a copy immediately. And may I be hopefully one of many to wish you best of the season and all successes in 2019 and beyond.
Thank you very much.
If you'd like to learn more of Yuki's delicious recipes, track down her book, Sushi at Home, The Beginner's Guide to Perfect Simple Sushi, and that is available from Penguin Books. You're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly Christmas special on Monocle 24. We'll be hearing from cinema legend Robert Zemeckis next. Forrest Gump, Back to the Future, Castaway, Death Becomes Her, Romancing the Stone, Who Framed Roger Rabbit. We're not just reading the afternoon TV schedule for Christmas Day. These are just a handful of legendary films that our final guest actually made.
In a career spanning more than four decades, few filmmakers have challenged the possibilities of blockbuster movie making quite like Robert Zemeckis. But there's more to his special effects laden treats than mere smoke and mirrors. He won the Academy Award for Best Picture and Best Director in 1994 for the aforementioned Forrest Gump. And his latest film, Welcome to Marwen, which is based on a true story, sees Steve Carell taking on the role of Mark Hogenkamp, a celebrated artist who, after a violent attack, retreats into a world built in his backyard, inhabited by dolls.
Monocle's Ben Ryland spoke to Robert Zemeckis about visual effects in today's cinema, calls for a reboot of Back to the Future, and how the real-life story of Hogenkamp and his photography inspired the new film. And here's a clip.
What is all of this?
The world-famous Marwen, Mark's art installation.
So that's the guy.
Yeah, it's right up there.
Some Nazi thugs jumped him. It's a miracle he survived.
I was a hell of a good artist, and now I can barely write my name. So my dolls have to tell the story.
The first thing was, I was taken with this story that I describe as a story about the healing power of art. And I identified with that, you know, instantly. And I thought that that was just a beautiful story. And that was the first thing. And the second thing was this idea that these photographs that Mark Hogenkamp took, in between those photographs, he had this elaborate drama that was happening in what I'll call the doll world, but it was in his own mind. And I thought, now that's something that movies can do. That's something that's a cinematic idea, to be able to bring the doll world to life, if you will. So those two ideas basically were the type of thing that I'm always looking for to make a movie.
And a more obvious route to take to make this might have been just to make a straight biographical picture, but you chose to utilize the dolls in a very fascinating way. I would suppose about half the movie is told with animated dolls. Is that something that stuck out to you from the beginning, that the dolls were going to play a very strong part in telling the story?
Yes, very much so. I thought that would give us an insight into everything that was going on in the main character's mind. You know, so I like the idea that there are these two dramas that are going on. There's live action drama and then the doll world drama. And then at some point in the movie, they start to blend together. And, you know, you don't realize where one leaves off and the other one starts. But then again, that's completely appropriate because it's all happening in one man's, you know, imagination.
And of course, a key part of this is the fact that the central character, Hogenkamp, played by Steve Carell, he's using these dolls to deal with the after effects of having been savagely beaten. But there's also an element here of him expressing how it feels to have an anxiety attack and to deal with anxiety with the way that the dolls sort of come together and he loses himself into some of these scenarios. How much research did you have to do into what anxiety is really like during the production of the film?
Well, I didn't do too much formal research. I just came up with this notion that when the anxiety gets to a high sort of stress level, the sort of doll world would become more manic and more violent and more action-packed, kind of as if it was, an explosion in your head. And I kind of just ran with that notion, not knowing whether it's clinically correct or not. I really don't know. But I think it, from a creative standpoint, it seems to be expressive enough to work.
Well, it's certainly something you read about a lot, people talking about how they deal with anxiety. And it can, of course, culminate in those sorts of episodes. But of course, the real Hogenkamp had some degree of involvement in this film. How much did you discuss that side of what he went through before you embarked on the project?
A lot of my Mark Hogenkamp, the one that's in The Women of Marwen, is much more of a dramatization than whatever happened with the real Mark. I mean, it's certainly a hyper-reality. And, you know, so we took quite a bit of license with that. And Mark understood that this was going to be a fictionalized, dramatized version and not another, you know, complete document of his real existence.
When you're dramatizing someone like that, how does it feel from your perspective to know that you are taking someone who really exists and putting them on the screen, but with a degree of fiction? Of course, it happens all the time, but I wonder what it's like from your perspective to feel that degree of, I suppose, responsibility to know that you are putting an image up there that, while, of course, is fictional, still pays tribute to the original spirit. How do you go about doing that?
I think exactly the way you just described it. I mean, it's like, you know, you go to great lengths to, you know, to keep the true spirit of who the person is and what his real essence is, and to be just basically true to the major events that, you know, that you're depicting in his life. And I think that's the way I approached it, you know, just to absolutely be, as again, the word true to who he really is as a man.
It is on the face of it, a very inspirational story, a very charming story, and of the way it's told and the people who are involved in telling the story, all of the performances are really top-notch. But still, from the outside, it can seem like such a strange concept for a movie. If you were to read the basic synopsis on paper without knowing anything about it, it might come across as such an unusual story. Were you concerned that if you didn't play your cards right, that it might come out being too strange? Or was that really part of the appeal?
I think that what I think you're describing is that the film defies any genre. You can't really categorize it. You can't take the story and put it in a box or label the story. And that, of course, is something that's not very common nowadays in making movies. But I found that to be exhilarating, and I thought that, you know, if we're gonna make a movie that's, you know, different, let's make a movie that's different. And, you know, I think that the audience will hopefully appreciate something that, you know, tries to not be cookie cutter movie making like we're so used to seeing.
Well, something else that I found quite different is that this is a movie that uses a lot of very impressive special effects, and you've clearly had a lot of fun putting all of it together, but particularly those aspects. They're very theatrical, they're very over-the-top and exaggerated, and a lot of fun. But it's not often that you find special effects used in a way that furthers the emotion of a film. There are a lot of films that use CGI and special effects for big whiz-bang explosions, always in that impressive at a multiplex cinema. This one's using it to really involve you in the story in a much deeper way. How does that sit with you in the wider landscape of filmmaking at the moment? Do you find that CGI is maybe coming of age, I suppose? It feels like only not that long ago, a lot of film critics in particular were complaining about CGI kind of ruining the cinema.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, that everything that can be your greatest strength can also be your greatest weakness. And I think that, you know, when a new technology, I think in the history of movies, when a new technology is invented or comes to fruition, it's generally misused and it's used to show itself. But then after a while, what happens is that filmmakers, you know, understand how the tool should be used, and they use it in a way that makes it invisible, which, of course, is always what you want the technique of filmmaking to be. So I think you're right to say that, you know, CGI is coming of age. And the best thing that will happen is when the audience gets to a point where they're not sure or don't care anymore how the technique is done. Because that means then that, the audience never thinks about, I wonder where they have the microphone. You know, they never think about that in movies because it doesn't matter anymore. They're assuming that there's a way that sound is recorded and it's just recorded. Back in the early days of cinema, you watch early sound movies and you had people leaning into flower pots, you know. But anyway, I think that all movie technique will become commonplace. And hopefully if the filmmakers are doing the right job, their job correctly, they'll vanish into the story.
Do you ever feel like there's a risk of losing the spirit of filmmaking if people get a bit too carried away with some of the innovation that we've seen in recent times? I'm talking about maybe in particular scenarios where people have been so tempted by the amazing abilities of technology that they've actually brought some celebrities back from the dead. There's a commercial that's been doing the rounds starring Audrey Hepburn on a bus eating a chocolate, which a lot of people found to be just a little bit macabre. Can things go a bit too far?
Yeah, I guess they could. But what I think the biggest challenge is going to be in the next few years is when we're capable of creating a complete three-dimensional photoreal avatar actor that looks completely human. And I think we're just, you know, a couple of years away from that, and that'll be an interesting time in our world.
So are we talking about a future film starring James Dean, or are we talking about a future where movie stars could be entirely fictional as the roles they're playing?
You'll be able to do both. I mean, right now, I mean, we there are companies that specialize in, you know, finishing movies with actors who are either fired or unfortunately die in the middle of production. So it's being done now, except that, you know, no one knows exactly where that's happening. So it will be something in the future that I think we're going to have to, you know, figure out how to use that tool and see what we do with that.
How does that sit with you with where you are in your career at the moment? Because, I mean, looking back at some of the films you've made, you've travelled all over the place in regards to genre and the style of films that you make, even just the look of the films that you have made. Does that sort of future excite you? Do you think about all of the amazing possibilities that are still yet to come from Robert Zemeckis?
Innovation in the future is always something that I'm excited about. And I'm very grateful that I have a body of work that's pretty diverse. You know, I've been one of those few filmmakers who's been able to do films of all different types of subject matter and different genre. And I haven't had to be a filmmaker who does only one type of film. But yeah, I'm always excited about any future innovation and see where this amazing art form of the moving image can take us.
We've been looking forward. For a moment, I want to look backwards because in Welcome to Marwen, there are a couple of little Easter eggs there for fans of your Back to the Future films. And I know there has been some talk of reviving the franchise. And when they popped up on the screen, for me, I thought, oh, he's stoking the angry beast here because that's just going to get more and more people asking if there's more to come. Are you willing to divulge anything on what's been going through your mind?
Well, there's, as far as I know, there aren't going to be any more Back to the Future movies. And I appreciate that people are asking for it. But I think what they're really asking for, or what they're really saying in asking for more, is that how much they appreciate the ones that already exist, they wouldn't be what was expected. I mean, you know, we don't have that entire cast has aged 30-some years. And you know, the spirit and the energy of making movies in the 80s can't be recaptured. So I don't think the actual final product would be satisfying to the audience. But I do appreciate that's the way that they're showing their appreciation by saying, let's please have more. I get that. I get that completely. In this movie, there's a scene where our hero is asked to build a time machine. So as I was writing it, I was thinking to myself, well, if I went out into the street and collected a group of people and asked them what they thought a time machine would look like, I suspect that the majority of them would think it looks like a flying car. So I thought, well, that's what our hero would do, too. You make a time machine that looks like a flying car.
You've basically invented the popular notion of what a time machine looks like.
Yeah. And of course, it was designed to be this final grace note joke at the end of the first Back to the Future movie. And now here we are. And so, you know, I had no idea that was going to happen. But here we are.
Well, I want to look backwards just one more time, because there has also been talk of you being the man who's going to make The Witches happen all over again. A very much loved book, especially in this part of the world, a Roald Dahl classic. Is there any truth to the fact that you might be putting your directorial skills behind that?
It's a project that I've got in development, and it could very well happen. I mean, it's in early development now. I've got a notion of how to do that film in a way that, you know, could be quite interesting. And again, we now have the technological tools to realize that story in a way that it would be extremely elegant to see, and done in a way where you could actually, you know, have the creatures as they're described in the Roald Dahl book actually come to life the way that it is in the book.
Of course, we are talking just a few days after the director of the first version of The Witches, Nicholas Roeg, passed away. Mm-hmm. He was 90, left an extraordinary legacy all over filmmaking. How do you approach that challenge of adapting something? I won't say remake, because I think what you're describing isn't really a remake. It's another adaptation of the book. Does it play on your mind when you're approaching something that has been previously adapted? Even if you are going to adapt it your own way, I suppose there is still that lingering fact that this has been done, and viewers will probably have that earlier version in their head as they're going into the cinema.
Yeah, there always. I mean, and I think that I definitely thought about this long and hard when I did a version of The Christmas Carol, because it had been done like maybe 25 times. But I do think that it's exactly the way you described it. Instead of doing it sort of as a remake, you do it as a modern adaption. And it's not like you're taking the original adaptation that was the film version and changing that in any way. It's you're going back to the original source material and just re-envisioning it for the time that it is right now.
I must ask you one more question, and it is because I've been asked by multiple people to put this to you. Originally, Cher had been approached to play the Grand High Witch in the 1990 version, and she couldn't do it. Would you consider her for the Grand High Witch in your version?
Sure, she's a great actress.
Perfect answer.
Robert Zemeckis speaking to Ben Ryland there, and Robert's new film, Welcome to Marwen, starring Steve Carell, is in cinemas from New Year's Day. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly Christmas Special.
And that is it, Tom, for a festive edition 494 of the Monocle Weekly. I've thoroughly enjoyed today's show. Robert Zemeckis, Mark Gatiss, Yuki Gomi, wonderful talents all on this programme.
Rob, shall we thank our friends behind the glass, as always?
Let's do so. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall and Augustin Macellari, and our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and David Stevens. We'll be back next week for the last show of the year and some of our favourite highlights from 2018. For the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thank you very much for tuning in.